Len, I want to thank the organizers for allowing me to speak today. I'll make some small comments about early universe phenomenology after Weisep. Already my joke was already used up. So this is my slide about this talk, and I'll move on to talk about the effective theory of large scale structure, which the other thing that I've been working on lately. It's m squared phi square, and that we have to, that's the guy to rule out. It's the battle between Eva and her friends and Taylor of the Taylor series. And we'll see who has to. the thing is, apparently this 15 makes no difference. So anyway, I don't know. We'll see who has to say. So it looks like m squared phi squared. It looks pretty good. Of course, there's these tensions. And about these tensions, I really don't want to discuss too much about the tensions, so I will talk about something else. I know that a lot of our friends are working on this. We've heard a lot. I really like all of these various proposed explanations. Like the running is really my favorite, maybe. And because I think in that case, we can have even two Nobel Prizes, one for discovering inflation and the other one for ruling it out, just to the same. In the same, or maybe we give a bicep team for discovering inflation and Planck for ruling it out, or something like that. So I think it's great. And of course, there are many other solutions. So let's stop the jokes. So, but it's not so much of a joke about, anyhow. So let's see. So let's discuss some of the things. Some of these discussions that I'm going to mention now are similar discussions that we had with the temperature, right? So, and there's has been a lot of stuff going on in the archive. So I'm in the last few days. So I'm taking from things that I've seen in the archive from other people. So the first question that I think is quite interesting is, are these B modes primordial? And they are the obvious candidate is defect models, and here is what the. So I've just pulled down from the archive some example of what people are saying. So the point is the following. So if you look at one of these, let's see, which is the, is this okay? If you look at any of these curves, what you see are the predictions for defect models are these things that go like a power law. I really cannot see any of the, I don't know. Anybody? Anyway, so they are these power law type things. The reason they are a power law, you can understand with it from the equation at the bottom there. So all of just this causality argument. The defects cannot produce correlations outside the horizon, which is cannot produce correlations separated by more than like 2 degrees. So if you write the B mode power spectrum is some integral of the correlation function in real space of the Q Stokes parameter and the U Stokes parameter, some Bessel function. So if these correlation functions are have to vanish with some separation larger than 2 degrees, then at low L you can make a Taylor expansion of these Bessel functions and you get this L square kind of shape in that curve. So that, because the J0 is like a constant and we're plotting L square CL. So this shape of L square is pretty generic, and the indication from this data is this little bump that so if you're just looking at the BB, you see this little bump, and so that's what makes this defect model don't look so good. Naively, you would think that this power law extends to much higher L, like L of 1,000 or something like that. So you really, in order to mimic the data, just as you had to do in the case of getting the Doppler peaks, you need to get these strings or whatever they are to just be one per horizon or something like this, so that all move the peak in their predictions all at the lowest possible L you can. And so at the current time with the error bars that we have, you can, especially because of these high L points at a few hundred, you can probably live with that. So that's kind of where we are. Then, of course, the defects predict temperature fluctuations that do not look different than what the tensor modes predict. They extend to larger L, and so you can see if that is something that Planck would like or not like. Of course, this now gets you into this whole debate as to the tension and so on, so probably it's unclear how we're going to make. But it's clear that very, very soon, at least for detailed examples of a model with, if you want to actually produce these things with a defect or something like that, we will clearly be able to tell, just as happened quickly after the detection of the acoustic peaks in the temperature. So that's, and in the longer term, this reminded me of some paper that I had with Daniel Baumann some time ago. So just as we did for the temperature or the temperature and polarization cross-correlation in WMAP, what WMAP did, you can actually measure the cross-correlation in real space, and you should see it go to zero outside 2 degrees, and the B modes actually, of course, of inflation do have a correlation outside of 2 degrees. This bicep signal is so large that this will happen, not in so distant future, that there would be enough signal to noise to actually see outside the horizon correlation in the B modes, which is something that you cannot get from the defects, and that brings it to the level of mathematical theorem. But much before we can do that, we will see that the shape is all screwed up, if it's not defects, or if it's defects, of course, I think it's M squared phi squared. So so we will see that the shape doesn't quite look correct. So this is just telling us whether or not these B modes come from outside the horizon, and they're outside the horizon correlation. This kind of test of causality tell us that, and I think it would be very nice to do it. This B mode transformation from Q and U to B is non-local, and so you have to, in space, in the map, so you have to think a little bit about that. And I think probably it's something that it might be nice for experimentalists to think about, whether or not there's any gain in trying to start measuring also correlation functions in real space. For example, the Lenzing B modes, this anything that looks like a power law, like an L square thing, is just a Fourier transform of a delta function. So in the correlation function, it puts all the power in one in pixels that are very nearby. Well, now we're looking for the gravity waves. We're looking at correlations around a degree. So just like people in the BAO look for things in real space, it might be interesting to just to as a check. But okay, so. The next thing to ask, imagine we pass eventually this test, which we will because it's M squared phi squared. Then we will ask the question, we would know that the sources are from primordial, are not produced by something happening 400,000 years after the Big Bang during recombination or something like that. So then we can ask the question, can we generate gravity waves during inflation in another way, which is not vacuum fluctuations, and somehow produce this data. And I think there I can mention some work that we did some time ago with Eva and Leonardo. So the basic idea is that you can imagine the following scenario. You have the kinetic energy of the inflaton, phi dot square. That's much bigger than the h to the fourth, which is the energy density in the gravity waves that are typically generated. That's the standard answer of slow roll inflation, the h over m Planck value of little h. So if you somehow could transfer some of this energy into gravity waves, you can create a lot more gravity waves in principle that are there from the vacuum fluctuation. So we tried various examples in this paper of processes that you can do. But obviously, because there is inflation, and you want to emit gravity waves. So these gravity waves are going to be emitted now by some material during inflation that's moving around and emitting these gravity waves. So in inflation, everything that you have there dilutes itself. So what you have to do is continuously refill the universe with stuff that moves around and emits gravity waves. So it's a big job to start doing this, not a trivial. But okay, so we tried, and so you have to get the inflaton to lose energy all the time, fill the universe continuously with something that emits gravity waves. I think one thing that, you can go look at the paper, but one message that I want to say is the following. The gravity waves that Bicep has seen are really large, okay? So if you just think of the case of vacuum fluctuations, if you think of the standard formula that the h is phi over m Planck, or delta phi over the inflaton is h, the Hubble constant during inflation, This mechanism is putting equal amounts of gravity waves, equal amount of energy into the scalar fluctuations, the standard mechanism, and into the tensor fluctuations. Then the 16 epsilon is about the conversion between zeta and phi. So, typically, when we do these kind of examples, we end up with a way of producing gravitational waves that are much more inefficient. Under the normal circumstances, the emission of gravitational wave is not very efficient. So we end up with a much bigger separation between the scalars that we produce. We also produce scalars, and they're much bigger in ratio than the tensors that are being produced. The ratio seen by BICEP is so large that there's very little room. So you really have to start pushing things. And I don't want to spend too much time, but I think, you know, this thing is complicated compared to m squared phi squared, of course, but also it needs pushing. You need epsilons of 0.1, you need pushing. So it's not in the best of states, I would say. So let's then say that we are talking about vacuum fluctuations then during inflation. So I want to discuss some extensions that we've been discussing for a long time, and especially people interested in non-Gaussian is things like with a speed of sound, or some second field like the curvaton or variable decay rate, this kind of stuff that we've been discussing for quite a long time. What are the implications of BICEP for this? So let's take the speed of sound. The typical formula R is 16 epsilon, now comes with a CS. And I remind you that the constraint on CS from Planck is that, from the non-Gaussian, this is seen from Planck, is that CS has to be larger than 0.002. But clearly, you see that now we have R of 0.1 or 0.2. So if we want to make CS much lower than 1, like 0.1 or something like that, then we need to get epsilon of 0.1 rather than 10 to the minus 2, which is the epsilon of m squared phi squared. So this clearly starts being a little bit ridiculous because this epsilon is inside of the ns minus 1. There are 6 epsilon, so you have to start balancing one thing against the other. So this result does not want to change CS by much more than order 1. Maybe you can have CS of a half or something and you would be happy, but not a tenth, okay? And for the curvaton is the same thing. You now don't want to, you're again adding power, you're getting something that creates even more scalars. You have such a large ratio between scalars and tensors that you cannot really accommodate additional sources of scalars. It's very difficult to imagine that the curvaton is 10 times larger than, because of the same reason, than the standard scalar. So, okay, at this point in time, we can live with, you know, changes of order 1 of these things, but it's just amazing. No, we went from the measurement of CS from non-Gaussian 0.02 to a value of order 1, just boom, like this. It's just very, very interesting, I think. Then the next question that I wanted to discuss is, okay, we've been talking, especially people thinking about non-Gaussian, we've been talking for a long time about these models with low CS. Or in general, what is the implication of this large detection of tensors on non-Gaussianity? Should we still care about non-Gaussianity or not? And so I think some things need to be revised a little bit. But There are various, maybe these transparencies are too busy, but there are various forms of non-Gaussianity that we've discussed in the last few years. One of them is this local type of non-Gaussianity in which you have some other field contributes a little bit contributes to the density fluctuations, and it at the end of inflation, some other field, light field during inflation, at the end it converts into zeta. It can create this local type non-Gaussianity. This model is under tension because this has to be a very subdominant component, as I was arguing in the previous transparency. Most of the delta rho over rho needs to come from the inflaton, not too much from this other guy sigma. Still, if you run through the numbers, this doesn't mean that if this other guy is very non-Gaussian, there could not be a signal in the three-point function that's still consistent with having even small changes in the in the two-point function. So even if just from the scaling, or and how well we are measuring the non-Gaussianities. So it's not mathematically impossible to have large non-Gaussianities in this context, but still not touch the density fluctuation. Of course, it's contrived. We're adding this. I mean, of course, if we're landing on m squared phi squared, okay, it's contrived. But I'm just listing the things whether or not it's impossible to continue to have such a thing. So this, you know, now what about non-Gaussianities just in the context of single field that we've discussed for a long time in the context of this effective theory of inflation? The thing that is true, and we said over and over again throughout these years, is that if you have a small CS, then you have to have large non-Gaussianities. And this is because so the way this is constructed, the same operator that allows you to change CS, this thing that has pi dot square that comes with an m2 to the fourth, has in it, by the symmetries of the theory, has in it cubic interactions. So if you crank up this term in order to have a lower CS, you immediately have large non-Gaussianities, and this is the way Planck constrains the CS, okay? Now, there are other terms that start cubic, this m3 to the fourth and pi dot cube, that starts cubic. And so what Matt already said is that you could have this term large, and that's not changing the term that starts quadratic with the CS, okay? Now, one thing that is true is the following. If you have this term, and you, of course, if you have a cubic, these interactions, you can construct a loop, and you can see that you generate, out of this term, you generate a pi dot cube term, okay? And you can calculate how big that is. And you discover that if you have a term over here, then you generate a term with pi dot cube, which will produce comparable non-Gaussianities. So if you have a small CS, you expect to have non-Gaussianities both of this shape and the one produced by this other shape, because both of them are related, at least if you do the loop integral and you go all the way to the cutoff when you do the loop, when you do the estimate, you create both of them at the same order of magnitude. But what is not true, and that is the interesting part, I guess, is that if you crank up this term to have a large cubic non-Gaussianity here, then you need to go to this pi dot cube also comes inside of it comes additional interactions that you can make in a loop and create the CS term. It's not the case that even if you run the loop, all of the way to the cutoff, it's not the case that the cubic term coming from the quartic term coming from the pi dot cube generates a big CS squared. So it's perfectly okay to have large non-Gaussianities of the form of pi dot cube that does not change the CS. So in other words, in the context of this EFT of inflation, now the shapes are being cut in half. You can only have the shape that has to do with the pi dot cube and not the shape that has to do with the pi dot grad pi square, because that necessarily comes with the pi dot square that is the CS, and that is very constrained, okay? So that's what happens in the EFT of inflation. But this also tells you another thing. So today, even with the bicep measurement, we know that CS cannot be very different from 1. Okay. So when you crank up this pi dot cube and do the loop, you realize that you do change the CS. It's not that you do not generate any of this pi dot square piece. You do generate a little bit, but it's of that order of magnitude, delta CS of 1. So we are okay. As time goes on, we will zero in on m squared phi square, and we will see that just from the NSR plane, we will not be able to, we will eventually say that CS cannot be very large than 10 to the minus 2, and so on. So this mechanism, this will again be in tension under the assumption that when you crank up this and you estimate the CS, you run the loop integral all the way to the cutoff. So the way around this, and this has, there has been, the interesting dynamics that can happen here, is if you imagine that there are other fields that are light during inflation. In that case, say you had something a little bit heavier than Hubble, so at the Hubble scale, this this kind of effective theory makes sense, but then the cutoff when you run the loops is up to the mass of these particles, which is of order Hubble. So the loops are much more cut off, and so you don't generate any CS cranking up the non-Gaussianity. And so you are led to this monster stuff of the effective theory of multi-field inflation, which now this is a horrible table from a paper that I had with Leonardo, and now there are horrible tables from other people as well. This is Daniel Bauman and Daniel Green. They're great tables. I really like them. But all of these possibilities, all of these operators, okay? So, and the bottom line, but I think in the last in the last cycle of post-bicep excitement, this idea of low scalars has been even more advertised. For example, this paper here by Nathaniel and Daniel Green. At the end of the day, the bottom line is the following. So you imagine that there are some other scalars or some other degree of freedom that is light during inflation with a mass around Hubble. And it mixes with phi, which is the inflaton in this case. The interesting part about it mixes through a term like this. And the interesting part of the post-bicep discussion, one of the interesting parts, is that because now we know that phi dot is so large, the energy scale of inflation is so large, this mixing, even if you put lambda there of M Planck, it gives a large non-Gaussianity. In fact, in their paper, I copy and pasted this equation. And you can see that FNL equilateral, even if you put lambda of M Planck, is 75 is the current bound from Planck. So it's even large compared with that metric. Okay. So in other words, And this a little bit goes back to the Courbaton example and so on. So these are examples where there is some mixing of the inflaton, or there's some additional fluctuating thing that creates only a few percent change or something like that in the two-point function. Still, we measure non-Gaussianity so accurately that if this thing has order, if this thing that mixes with the inflaton has order one non-Gaussianities, then it can still be a very large non-Gaussianity in the detectable signal, even though it makes up a small change in the power spectrum. This is what these examples are about. Epsilon is 10 to the minus 2 from m squared phi squared, so this mixing is 10%. In the power spectrum, it makes a 1% difference. In the three-point function, it makes it's 10 to the minus 3, but that's the level that we are measuring the non-Gaussianity. This was all there prior to Planck, and this kind of model also has this for the people interested in large scale structure, have this very nice phenomenology of the squeeze limit having weird powers of k short over k long as you take the squeeze limit of the 3-point function. So there are very interesting models in that respect. Work that goes back to Chen. But I think, in addition to being some phenomenology that is allowed, still allowed, even though we now know that CS is very close to one, the other interesting part is that these mixings, which are not unreasonable, even if they are suppressed by the Planck scale, they can still lead to large effects if this other sector is in some sense quite non-Gaussian. So I think that's a pretty interesting. So that's a pretty interesting. Conclusion as well. So in that respect, I would say that the measurement has cut a big part of this non-Gaussianity. Even forget about any. If you think like me that it's m squared phi squared, it's okay, it's done. But even if you start thinking what is still allowed, it has cut it a lot. But there's still a lot of things that seem quite interesting. Okay. Let's continue with this theme that is going to be m squared phi squared. So this is just some futuristic plot in which you have m squared phi squared. Just I want to make a few points that I find interesting. So this is some very small content plot, but it's m squared phi squared, the prediction, and just some error bars, futuristic error bars in which you measure ns and sigma r and the tensor to scalar ratio 10 to the minus 3, okay? So this future that the experimentalist, their path is towards such a situation, okay? So imagine we realize this situation. The first thing that jumps to mind is that we really need to measure ns to to an accuracy comparable to what we are going to do in R, which and this seems pretty challenging because now we will probably have to deal with large scale structure. So it's very, I mean, we really have to work on NS. That, for, I think for most, that, that's a good summary of one thing that I wanted to say. The other one is that we are always plotting these predictions from inflation as, okay, M squared phi squared lives between 50 and 60 e-folds, and it looks like, okay, it's a little thing. Currently, it's this little thing. Who cares, okay? But when the error bars get like this, look at the size of the excursion between 50 and 60 compared to the error bars. It's ridiculous. So clearly, there's a lot of information there. We better start thinking how to use it, okay, for something, okay? Of course, the range of reheating temperature that goes is humongous, right? When you go, when you we now plot 60 and 50 or whatever, there's a big range of reheating temperature. But you know, we need to start talking about reheating. Okay, we need to start. I know there's a lot of freedom. I know this is a very blunt tool, but these guys are doing want to do this ellipse. Okay, we better work to not have this big or just make some use of this ellipse compared to this line, okay? Now, yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. All of this is very, at this level, of course, even one e-fold, the first thing, it makes a difference. So we have to work on this. I mean, here is just the standard, some simple formula from a book, T reheat G star, T reheating to the four. I mean, this is just, just to give you, it doesn't matter. Today, this doesn't matter. But in the future, this is, we might be there, not so even not so long in the future. Okay, so we have to use this. And of course, yeah. Yeah, or at least start thinking about this to extract information. Maybe we cannot really make a prediction, or it depends on a lot of things. But there's a lot of, there's information there. In fact, my favorite universe is this one, is M squared phi squared with the highest possible reheating temperature. Because anything that you do in the late universe always pushes you, adds and decreases the number of if you put a matter there. So I really want to be here so that there's, you know, nothing that you can do. And furthermore, it gets so hot that you have to worry about it during reheating, creating all kind of stuff that are bad for you and everybody. So this would be the maximally informative M squared phi squared with the highest instantaneous reheating. That's my preferred universe. But in any case, I think we need to start working about it. Of course, within these error bars, other things like phi are even outside of the plot. So it will be a completely different era when we get there. And we really, it's just incredible. I mean, it's just, okay, it's very futuristic, but not so futuristic, I think. And of course, yeah. Now, what if it's not M squared phi squared? I'm not willing to even entertain this possibility. No, I think it's fine if it's not M squared phi squared. I hope that it's, we only need to check a few options, okay? If it's anything goes, it's just not, you know, it's just not so, I mean, fine. It's like, I hope it's M squared phi squared. If not, it's not so nice. Okay, so let me finish there, okay?
If Slava Mukhanov were here, he would completely applaud with you.
Well, okay, of course I'm joking, I don't mind, but whatever it is, it's okay with me. But one thing that is good about, so you can have two philosophical points of view. One, that we are trying to learn physics from observations in astronomy, okay, and then oh, we see p to the 2/3 stuff, brain stuff like this going on. That sounds great. That's one philosophical, which I half the time I like. But the other one is we want to know what happened at the beginning in the universe from known physics, like Big Bang nucleosynthesis. It's great that it has worked. We use we didn't try to get the quarks out of the lithium abundance. Okay, so it's from known physics. We want to know what happened, and known physics in this business, it looks like only M squared phi squared, because known physics, we don't know. We want to talk with Mr. Taylor, tells me Taylor series. This is as much as the known physics goes, right? So if it's M squared phi squared, it's more in that line in which nobody will debate that it's inflated. If every number comes like that, who will start with, you know, contractions and bounces if you land in there? The whole discussion is completely mute. I don't know, Robert. I would think that if we land there, you will not do string gas cosmology and stuff like this, okay? I think. So if that's the case, then, you know, we've learned something for sure. If it's some middle of the ground thing, I don't know. We will have debates forever about all kind of things. So anyway, let me stop there.
Can I just make a small question?
Yeah.
So I was looking back at the paper on the extra sources, and I agree that's a totally exotic possibility.
Yeah.
But there was a big difference between the particle case and the string case, actually. The particle case had this tie to epsilon that you mentioned, but the string case didn't. It was actually oddly less constrained by the scalar power, for what it's
worth.
It's
true. I do think that we have to go there. We have to go and revisit this very carefully, I think, because we really now have a situation in which we are competing against a mechanism that is producing the same amount of energy in the scalars and in the gravity waves, and it looks, I mean, the slow roll thing, and that sounds like a pretty efficient thing, and so, you know. And furthermore, let's not debate our own paper between ourselves, okay? But then we're cranking up apps. I think that is the example that is, it's worth in that paper to look in more carefully. For the other examples, you need to live with the entire temperature signal being created by these scalars, and then we have to worry about the non-Gaussianity. We can start pushing things, and it could be maybe okay. But I think And the data is so nice that this paper that's wiggly, squiggle, squiggle, is outdated. If we want to say that this is a real possibility, we need to have a calculation. Yeah.
What's your opinion on having to deal with the live bound in M squared phi squared?
Well, I guess it was not an issue. I don't know. No, of course, yeah. I mean, this field was driven by the live bound. And I think it's a very good argument. And I think the corollary of the argument is that we will not see M squared phi squared, but we will see something. Because there's a large field excursion, and so the potential will flood, and something will happen. So it's a very good prediction. And we'll see who is right, OK? That's what I want to say. I now am a believer, at least for this week, on M squared phi squared.
So,
I mean, unless they eventually find another principle by which you can stretch the potential arbitrarily because there is some place in the landscape that is, who knows, and they found it, and I don't know.
So I'm just curious to know, what rules that CS bigger than 1? Because you said CS should be around 1, so why couldn't it be, 5, 10?
I'm a pretty conservative person, and... And I'm also in Princeton, which is a conservative location, at least the part of Princeton that I inhabit. So I cannot, and this is recorded, I cannot talk about CS bigger than 1. I don't know, I have tenure, but I don't know if it will even protect me in that case.
Okay. So on that,
I think
if someone comes back and says FNL is 120 plus or minus 2.
A lot of them are already ruled out by the data, no? Like it depends on which FNL we're talking about. I think if you restrict yourself to values that are still allowed by the data, you can accommodate this. This is at the same level as R, right? So, it was a gigantic fishing expedition going after R, and it turned out to be good. Now, are we going to get lucky and get 2 of these things? It's probably lucky square is more improbable. But, okay, we're going to do it.